Right, so this is our last class on the burning house. Next week, we will start this book, Illumination by Rebecca Lee, A Guide to the Buddhist Method of No Method. You can look on the website for more information and a link about it. Yeah, so it's about Zazen, it's about our practice. We're going to be moving our way pretty quickly through the book because we only have a month before precept study starts. So this will just be the four, I think it's four Tuesdays in February. And it says on the website which chapters we'll be covering as we go. So I think it'll be really interesting. So tonight, got to come here and fire up my my online features that I'll share at some point. So we're wrapping this book up, and so I ended up kind of saying that we're covering like one, I think it was like three or four chapters in this one night, but essentially all of these chapters have to do with change. So, you know, we've talked about, you know, a Buddhist response to the climate and ecological emergency and various teachings that apply and are useful in transforming anger and touching our grief and, you know, ethical relationships to this issue. So tonight is about change. What needs to change? What does a transformed world look like? How can change happen? What are we doing to bring about change? So a little bit about what needs to change, very briefly. So as many of you are aware now, I mean, we've known about the likelihood of anthropogenic global warming for well over 50 years. But it really didn't come into the public consciousness until around 2001, when the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came up with their first big report on it. Or that wasn't their first big report, but that was their first report where they said, uh-oh, in a really clear way. And then really, like, there was a major shift in 2018, October 2018, when the IPCC report, which had been getting, you know, coming out for a few years, I think, actually gave us a deadline, actually said, if we don't keep things below 1.5 degrees Celsius over, you know, pre-industrial times, these, you know, all of these awful things are going to become worse and worse and worse. So this is the goal. And if we want to do that, we need to halve our emissions by 2030. And so this was a very concrete, you know, finally, we had kind of had a concrete, like, number, like, this is the deadline, this has to happen, this is how fast it has to happen. So that was a, Extinction Rebellion came on the scene, Greta Thunberg came on the scene. You know, it's like suddenly people were talking about it a lot more and more aware of it. So that was 3.5 years ago. And I'm just going to share a little visual that helps us see what we're talking about. Hopefully, I am a co-host and can share. Yes, there you go. So this is a very interesting graph, greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a really fascinating, from the time, you know, pre-industrial times to now. And there's a very fascinating time lapse here that you could play. You guys got it up there? That is, I just like time lapse just made it like whoa, because you can't really see the scale of how long it stayed like that and then it went up. So, here is the dip during COVID. Here is 2021, and in 2022. Total greenhouse gas emissions went up again. Not like sometimes you'll hear it said like they're accelerating. They're not accelerating anymore. They are somewhat leveling off. But here's a piece about like what needs to happen. So this is, and I couldn't arrange get this except kind of this through this Facebook animation. So this is like, okay, 2018. This is what they said needed to happen. And but Ina said, but if it doesn't happen, if we want to stay below 1.5, this is how quickly we have to cut emissions, right? So we're talking about if we want to stay on this goal, which this UN panel has identified as being very important, the change that we are seeing, the like just kind of at least we're not accelerating so fast, is not anywhere near enough. So something needs to change. I mean, right? Something needs to change. So the world is going to change radically over the next 5, 10, 20 years if we overshoot this 1.5 degrees, and probably even if we don't. And every fraction of a degree makes things worse. So, that argument that kind of it's too late is like, is ridiculous, right? Nothing is too late. Like anything that we do to mitigate and decrease is going to keep things from getting even worse. So, read a little bit here. The Earth has become our supply house and our sewer. Clearly, it only has a finite capacity for both. Our demands on Earth are accelerating as the industrial growth society demands growth. The financial system depends on credit and an assumption of growth to pay back loans. Faced with dire predictions about 2 to 4 degrees temperature rises, it's important to remember the possibility that we can still meet our needs without destroying our life support system. However, to achieve this will require what Joanna Macy calls the Great Turning. So Joanna Macy, as many of you know, she's a Buddhist teacher and activist. She's been very socially engaged and has done a lot of work around trying to help people connect with this issue and take action on this issue. So we, well, a few years ago, we went worked our way through her book, Active Hope. So she calls it the Great Turning. This is the transformation from an industrial growth society to life-serving systems. These sustain the needs of humans and other life forms without jeopardizing the prospects of future generations. Macy points out that this Great Turning is already happening, and it's happening in three essential areas. Actions to slow the damage to the earth and its beings, analysis of structural causes and the creation of structural alternatives, and a fundamental shift in worldview and values. So I always found this very interesting, this way to break up the ways that we need to address change. There's the obvious ones that we usually think about is like protest and stopping and to stop the harmful actions. But then of course there's a lot of stuff going on out there which are like, here's a system which isn't working. What are some alternatives? You know, regenerative agriculture, alternative ways of making decisions and structuring communities and building houses and, you know, planning cities and doing our transportation. And it's, you know, it's all pretty exciting and encouraging stuff, actually, when you start to delve into it. It's just a matter of like, there's all these possible solutions, but there's not so much of a will to like shift our resources and attention over to these solutions, right? The will to do it isn't there yet, to the extent it's needed. So that fundamental shift in worldview and values, I personally find really inspiring. I mean, there's part of me that feels obligated to do it all, and I want to get out there and like protest and stop things. But on the other hand, kind of my heart, and given what I do for a living, thinking also about this other aspect of like, how can we work on changing, just shifting our cultural values and, you know, social systems, to bring about this change. So this ties to me to what something that Shantikarma, the author, talked about in a previous chapter when he talked about the parable of the burning house and how, you know, so the father's house is on fire and all his children are stuck inside, and he's trying to get them to come out, but they're all caught up in their with their toys and they won't come out. So he said, you know, he yells at them, tells it's really dangerous, come on out, and they don't listen to him. So he says, like, I've got the most amazing toys out here. You should come and see. And so they all like get excited and they come out of the house. And he doesn't really have the toys that he said he did, but like, you know, the greater reward is that they survive and all that. So, but the kind of the point that he made at that time is like, in a way, to change minds and hearts, we need to have another vision. You know, he called it a cry of inspiration, something to get people to turn towards some alternative, as opposed to making people feel guilty, you know, moralizing, or just, you know, forcing changes on people. So, in the Be the Change chapter, he has this section which I thought was relevant. So he was talking about Marshall, what's his name? His first name. He's the non-violent communicator. Marshall Rosenberg. Okay, so Marshall is first name. Marshall saw in himself and his activist colleagues that social change efforts tend to focus on what Joanna Macy called holding actions. This is when we try to stop people from doing things that are experienced as harmful by others. With holding actions, there's a risk that we end up trying to fight the existing reality. As we saw in the previous chapter, if you want to change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. In terms of the parable of the burning house, this new model is expressed in the cry of inspiration that persuades the children to run to safety. Marshall's cry of inspiration was to be the change. For the record, I do believe that the climate and ecological emergency is an ethical issue, and I want to respond in an ethical manner. However, I'm also aware that this approach has limited appeal and has been tried already. So we need a cry of inspiration to be the change and show a different way that is less costly and more fun. In my experience, this is usually more of an effort than standing in the street and holding up a sign saying stop. Despite this, transforming the social structure within ourselves is more likely to result in sustainable social change. As Buddhists, we need to recognize the power. Okay, he part of this chapter was on Dr. Ambedkar, who was a activist for Indians, the Dalit class, the untouchable class in India. And so he led a social justice movement. He himself was also a Dalit. And part of the process of this was to encourage all of them to convert to Buddhism, because in a way, like that, to try to fit within the Hindu worldview was very difficult. And instead, they adopted Buddhism and found within it many, many values that were beneficial to their movement. As Buddhists, we need to recognize the power of Dr. Ambedkar's example and teaching, which is relevant for the whole world. We need to focus our social and political engagement on this kind of fundamental change in outlook and attitudes, rather than specific outcomes. We need to focus on what underlies the climate and ecological emergency, which is the way people see life and live life. Only this kind of fundamental shift is congruent with the scale of the emergency. We have a distinctive contribution to make by spreading a different perspective on life. A more ethical outlook will lead to a more just, wholesome, and fulfilling society. The Dharma can be a transformative force in society. So he talked in this book about many ways that the Dharma can apply in this particular situation. But I was also thinking, in terms of this cry of inspiration, that one of the first Buddhist lessons that I really took to heart and found helpful was the teaching that all beings without exception, simply want to avoid suffering and be happy. No matter what they're doing, no matter how harmful, no matter how like deluded they are in the way that they're trying to go around being happy, that's what they're trying to do. That's what they see themselves as doing. So if they're causing harm, it's because of grasping or fear or ignorance. They think that what they're doing will bring about the happiness they seek, or they don't see any other options, or they're stuck in their habits or mindsets. So he was pointing in these chapters, when we see people, including ourselves, doing harmful things or not doing helpful things, we can ask what needs are we trying to meet? And how else could those needs be met? I think all of us, almost all of us, are going to agree that like our society is sick in so many ways, right? And that, we have this emphasis on materialism and on divisiveness. And we don't want to be going along with this. And yet, what else can we do? So I thought it would be fun to do an adaptation of the exercise that he suggested in here, which is to imagine you've had a very vivid dream about a time in the near future where societies around the globe have been transformed from industrial growth societies to life-serving ones. And you wake up to find the dream has become reality. Then describe what you see. What are people saying to each other? What are they doing? What are they putting their energy into? What are they using their resources for? What are the new social practices? So I thought we could do a brainstorm, and I will share screen, but hopefully those of you at home have a way to adjust your view so you could see a few other people at least, and don't have to just see the screen.
You repeat the question that we're dreaming about?
Yes. And I it's kind of on here too, so. And do you guys see exactly what I see? No, you see a few people, but. So I don't know if you can make that any bigger, see more people. Yeah. Okay. So waking up in a life-serving society. What is happening? What are people doing? How are they spending their resources? How are they getting their needs met in a more life-giving, sustainable, less materialistic way? What values have changed in society? And if you are in the cloud, you will probably need to use the raise hand feature under reactions and then click raised hand because I can't see everybody, so I might not be able to see a physically raised hand. And then you'll pop up on my screen. So I can start in that, like, what was it? It's one of the recent kind of sci-fi books about climate breakdown. What is it? Ministry for the Future. Very, very imaginative book. So it takes place in the near future. And it's not like a Pollyannish kind of thing, but like by the end of the book, there's like we're finding our way. And it's really interesting the way that it has imagined that. And one of them is like, basically, there's these airships. Like if you're going to go overseas or you're going to go a long distance instead of in a jet plane, it's these big kind of slow airships. And it's just understood that travel is going to take a long time. And like, so just like expectations about all of that has slowed down. It's understood that travel is going to take a long time. And it's interesting that in the book they portray that's like there's a positive quality to that. So I would just say like, slow, huh?
They slow down.
Yeah, travel slowing down. Coral.
Yeah, like less individual ownership, like shared resources and items.
I have a fantasy. I don't know, like, but because this is a dream and we're waking up, so we can just have anything. So like for me, every neighborhood has a community center. Like, you know, for just like maybe there's 500 houses, maybe, and like you have a community center. There's like a coffee shop. There's a tool lending library. There's a daycare. There's like you can just go there, and it's open to the community and.
I love that because I try that now. If I need a wheelbarrow, instead of going to people buying one, I'll like think of all my friends who might have one, make them feel uncomfortable, borrow it from them. In the meantime, I get to chat with them and tell them about my project, and then I lend them something, and it's great.
Jimmy.
Now I also have a hand up. They value life above all else.
Valued life above all else, and that is like he was talking about in the book, like that is figured in. Like we start including those kinds of things in the whole economic equation, is these costs to life and culture and beauty and whatever. Natalie.
And I know this isn't a new concept, but really to put it into action, is that people talk about gardens everywhere, food everywhere, and that it's front yards, backyards, sidewalks, media
Yeah.
strips, roofs, in your house, out of the house, and that you can just go, everyone can go out and pick it. And, you know, fruits, vegetables, medicinal herbs, you know, growing medicine, food, everybody has access to it all over the place. And we're not, and we're eating what's right there. So we're going to cut all the emissions from transporting things from far away, because everywhere you go, you have the food that you need right outside your door.
Are cloud people able to hear what people are saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just make sure to speak up so we're not having people come up. Yes, access everywhere. And I've been thinking about that with it's becoming very clear that our infrastructure in various ways can collapse pretty easily and quickly.
Yes.
And we're all just complete sitting ducks with nothing. We don't know how to do anything. We don't have access to anything. Yeah. Let's see. Let's take a couple cloud. Leah.
This is kind of relating to the earlier less individual ownership and community sharing, but I just have to mention, because these are real things that really happen. So I'm a big fan of the gift economy, and there's something called Buy Nothing and Buy Nothing Beaverton groups and Buy Nothing fill in the blank Portland and whatever, where you just post what you have and then people just take it, and it's gift economy stuff. And then back in San Jose, we had a thing called the Really Really Free Market, RRFM, mm-hmm. which in the Central Park, in the neighborhood, it was just like a postage stamp of a park. But every week people would show up and just spread out blankets and just bring all their crap, you know, like that they don't want. And then people would just go around and go, gee, I could use one of those. And, you know, okay. And then there's no money. It sounds radical, but these things have happened. So they could totally happen on a larger scale. So,
and all of this is I don't know. I've lived in my house for 7 years and I do not know most of my neighbors.
Ooh.
I've only gotten to know the right next door neighbor over the last year or two. I don't have to rely on them for anything. And it's awkward. I can't just show up on their doorstep and say, look, can I borrow stuff? So something has to socially lubricate this whole scenario, right? That's why I like the kind of the community center idea, because then you're not we kind of have this protectiveness about each other's space. But Rachel?
I'm thinking of more people learning more hands-on skills, like being able to make their own fabric, being able to make their own clothes, being able to make their own soaps, make their own candles, things like that. Like, we already have that here, but more sustainable, more out there, where you can go with that, with the less individual ownership gift economy, where you can spread out a blanket and have all the clothes you made out and have everything that you've made, and be like, here, I can gift you this, and we can do a trade and things like that. That would be really cool, I think.
And related to that, you're inspiring me. I envision in this life-sustaining world, our economy has been completely revamped,
mm-hmm.
and wealth has been redistributed, because one of the things that I see as a huge limitation in terms of building community, in terms of making our own things and growing our own food, all of this is who has the time, right? We're so caught up. We all have so much work to do just to pay our bills and keep the roof over our head, that it's almost people's energy is just being consumed by this whole system. We don't have any extra to just kind of chill. So I feel like, I don't know what we did, guaranteed income or something, so that we had more space. We have more space to do some of these other life sustaining things. So I don't know how to put that, but like economy revamped, more time for everyone. Ruth Ann, did you have something?
Yes, actually, it was a program that was working, I believe, in Louisiana. It's called the grandparent program because working parents, as you say, are so busy and we're social creatures. And I'm a senior and I live in a facility where a lot of old people have a lot of time. And in this program in Louisiana, parents would sign up to have some senior they would never meet call their child at home and encourage them about to build a relationship just over the phone, short talks, and it cut down on truancy in early elementary grades. Because sometimes parents, in the morning schedule, getting everybody out of the house. And this would, it really added to a child's sense of kind of self-reliance, just encouraging them, building up a relationship. And most kids like to talk on the phone, but it was using the free time that older people have. To kind of hook in with children because our families are so kind of not connected physically with always their family of origin, I mean, relatives. So I'd like to see that in the future.
Thank you for sharing. That reminds me too of I heard a story about a like in Japan. So similarly, they'd have these kind of community places. I can't remember what the basic idea of it was, but essentially, like the old people would go and hang out there, because a lot of them are lonely and don't have kids around anymore. So go and just hang out there. And then you would find parents would be like, okay, I know my babysitter fell through. And so they've got their kid and they just go down there and they'd be like, can you watch them for a while? So it was just like, and I'd be like, yeah. So, again, building those relationships. And then I'm thinking in a deeper level like that, these things that we're talking about, some of them don't seem to have necessarily a direct relationship to the climate and ecological crisis. And yet, when you think about, meeting people's needs at a deeper level, so they don't have to go out and like just seek it through materialism or whatever, that, it could all be just a little mellower and happier. Let's see.
Sure.
All right, back to the okay. I got five people on here. All right, who's okay, Yoli.
So, I've been thinking, I don't know if you guys heard the story about the kite CEO, the baby kite CEO who fired a woman whose baby was in the ICU because she could not guarantee that she'd be returned to work 2 weeks after for 6 months. And I'm too old to have children at this point, but I would love a society that valued motherhood, that where women don't have to make a choice between their children and a job, where they can bring their children to work and their daycare centers, where they can visit with their kids so that they're not gone 8, 10 hours a day.
Don't get about Scandinavia.
Yeah.
I know that some organizations do that, but it's just not prevalent. And this person who's the CEO of a baby, like a baby store, right? She fired her employee because her child was in the NICU.
Andrew.
I'll just add just a quick comment. It's already been mentioned, but something that I've noticed in the few times I've been to Germany is one thing they do there is they have these, I'm not sure exactly how it works, but from what I understand, they have these, you can rent these small plots And each, it's a, you know, I don't know, it's not maybe half the size of this room. It's not a huge thing. It's got a little garden and a little shed, and you rent it out, and people just go just outside of town, and they grow their food in their plot, and they have their tools there and everything. You can't sleep there. There's rules to it. But you can just, yeah, sometimes on the train going to Germany, you can just go on, you can just see just these plots forever and ever and ever, just plot after plot after plot.
They call them allotments. And,
but here we use up all the spaces for another, you know, another, or another, yeah.
Was there another one in the dirt and dirt? All right. Jade.
So this is about gardens everywhere, and also kind of how, you know, you mentioned with, say, with the green travel, you know, there's kind of like, it requires approaching travel with different expectations, right? It can kind of seem like, oh, maybe you're losing something, but also you're gaining something. And I feel like that's kind of true with like gardens everywhere and relying less on a globalized food supply chain. You're not going to be able to get strawberries in the middle of winter, but what we will get is like you to actually enjoy like seasonal vegetables, because there'll be more of that. And also, I was talking with someone the other day about how many heirloom species we've lost and hyper-regional cultivars. Can you imagine like if the kale that we had here tasted different from, say, just the kale over in Salem? Like, if you traveled over there, the vegetables would all taste different because everyone's growing them there themselves. And there's greater, I don't know. That sounds really cool and exciting. And that would be really neat. But yeah.
And if it was a value to understand and cultivate where you live. Most of us have no connection to the land that we're actually living on. We don't know what would actually grow here. We don't know what's native here. We wouldn't know how to cultivate the soil. We don't, like,
yeah.
And in doing that, we get more appreciation for our interdependence with nature, or connection to the earth. I mean, that's what I'm really interested in, and like, we're going for with like this thing we're doing on Saturday, which is like going out and connecting with, you know, the actual land, with actual nature. Cause it's when we just do it in our minds and we just think of like a pretty, you know, a pretty view or something, it's not the same as going out and touching it and being surrounded by it and smelling it. Susan.
Well, I would like to change the economy. I would like to get rid of mega stores and have all what we used to call mom and pop stores, where you'd go in and the people would be proud of what they're selling. They'd know that you would know the owner. Just like when I go to my coffee shop, I know the people there. But I'd like other stores to be like that too, just very local. And our choices would be limited, but that would be fine.
And it's seems like it'd be pretty easy to just put a cap on how big corporations can get.
Yeah.
Like, too big. Now you gotta split into two different corporations. And like, you know, just let's see. Brian, are you next? I think people stay more or less in the same order. You're still muted.
Okay. I'll use an example basically. Singapore, the garden city of the Orient, one of the most beautiful places to go. There, it's completely different. The culture is different. They have three generations living together, the father, the family, and the children. They have areas in Singapore, large, like I'm talking about many different areas, but each area stands on its own. You don't have to go from one district to another district to buy something. Every district has what it really needs of stores, but they have skyscrapers because they can't build flat. They have to grow, build up. But this is out, like not right downtown. This is like, it's a garden city. Like the whole city is the island. And they have like 20 story buildings where there'll be maybe six of these skyscrapers together in a little complex. One of them is the factory where they work. And then they got the accommodations and another one. But the interesting part is the first couple floors, the first floor basically is like big pillars coming down, and there's no, and that's like a community center under, right on the ground level, and everything is green down there. And down there, they have daycares, stores, clinics, everything. And you drop your kid off at the day center, you go and work, you come home, but it's a park-like environment all around you. Their mass transit system puts anything anywhere in the world to shame. Clean, efficient, covers everything. You don't have to want a car. You can't afford a car there. Cars are $200,000. The parking stall downtown could cost you as much as the car. If you want to buy a new car, you have to get rid of your old car. It has to be taken off the island for a new one to come on. The licensing is more expensive almost than the car. I mean, they've already gone this, and they've been doing this. I mean, I've been there on and off for 30, 40 years, and it's been like that. And they're so far ahead of us, but you give up all your freedoms to have a good quality style of life. That's all.
Okay, that was a big parting word. But I mean, I think that does point to, like, in terms of change in values, I can think of a whole list of things that I could describe as negative, right? Our individualism, our wanting to have what we want now and all of this. But if, if offered an alternative, and the I don't know, like, because somebody just mentioned, like, generations living together. But how many of us want to live with our parents, or, because we have the choice. I've chosen to move far, far away from my family because this is where I want to live, and I want to be in Oregon, and I want to do this, and I want to do that. And I don't think that should go away. I don't want to go to, like, the flip side where, like, individual desires and choices are completely, set aside for the good of the group or the family. And yet, I think I would like to see a balance, a little bit of a, do you want to go away, or do you, it's important to be with family. Okay, I'll take one from the cloud, or one from the dirt, one from the cloud. Chinry.
Real fast. Products are built to last. And when they break, we fix them.
You can't even find repair shops for most things anymore. And the cheap plastic, there's nothing. You just take the whole thing and throw it in the trash.
I made microwaves in 17 years.
I fixed the heel of a boot once, and people are like, that. Yeah, there are people that actually fix shoes.
Dennis.
Imagine that. A person who fixes a shoe, what are you talking about?
I love those.
Yeah, I'm looking at your economy revamped comment. Even before we can think about revamping the economy, we have to think about how we're being sold things. Advertising. That's, to me, is the actual nucleus of the problem. We're being sold that we need all this stuff, and we're drowning in it. Our attention is being sold. I mean, Facebook and all the other programs like that, Instagram and all that, sell your attention to advertisers.
So
And
how would you in this dream world, how has it
yeah,
been changed?
this may be too concrete, but I would legislate the crap out of it. Like, you just can't do this. Just put some guardrails up. it's totally out of control now. Kids, adults are being sold things that are just outrageous. The concepts as well as products.
Yeah, I can picture, and I'm imagining there's some of this out there, but it sure seems to me like in this dream world, like a core part of the education, like starting right in grade school, is like education about social media and advertising and news and what can you trust and, you know, curating information and all of that. Like, that should be like at the core of the education. About, I don't know what you call it, like social influences or.
Well, the economy also, it's our economy is 100% transactional. I don't give anything unless I get something. And that's really concrete. And other societies are not like that. You know, there's more room there for giving freely. So anyway.
Stephanie.
So in my dream, I wake up and I go out to my garden and I make me some fruit and some veggies because my garden's right there. And then public transportation is amazing. And I'm able to get up to public transportation and go right to work. They say that they put millions of dollars in public transportation, but you cannot find anywhere from West Lynn to Beaverton. That's not going to take 3 hours. I'm talking about, you know, like a super shuttle that will go from Portland to Salem or from San Francisco to LA. And now we just, if we could create those, maybe underground, I know it's expensive to do that, but that type of public transportation where you literally go and walk a half a block, you get on the public transportation and you get dropped off at work, or incentives for carpooling. You know, I think like, let's have a good incentives for employers to carpool where it's feasible and just easy. That's my dream.
I mean, when you go to places, usually big cities, where this is, they do have, you know, it's enough density and enough reason for there to have come up with the mass transit, right? Limited space and all that. It's cool. Like, nobody wants to have a car. It's awesome. But here it is, like, and we're so spread out. So like city planning has to change too. But one of the things I really, really want to see is like high speed rail across the US. I would prefer to take the train. I really would prefer. I really don't like going up in a metal tube in the sky. I just don't think it's natural, but a train is lovely, but I cannot afford to take the Amtrak, not because of the money, but because of the time. To go visit my family in Minnesota would essentially take like an extra 4 days. I don't have that much time. With it also the, like the, you know, but if we did have a little more time, right? Maybe we just expect it to be slower. So could shift in many ways. Denny.
Oh, wow. My emotions are all stirred up, so I don't even know if I'm going to be able to speak straight. I just want to get real just for a minute or two and say that I want to bring it back to you can be the change, because I'm experiencing, you know, several of these things right now just because a group that I knew, different kinds of groups, decided to just make it happen. Like the getting the neighborhood together and having two or three people who have gardened for a long time teach other people how to garden and get discounts from seed companies. And we had a place where we did have daycare for elder people and children for about 8 years, and it worked well. And then we lost the building, and we haven't been able to put it back together. And there's a farm, 40-acre farm, 10 minutes from me, that is totally run by the small city or the small county. It's a middle to low income county. And they have a farmer's market on Wednesdays where you pay what you can. And they've worked it now where there's food stamps. Kids, they have programs for kids to go in. And all the way up through teens to learn how to farm. And they start with just sticking seeds in the ground, and it's brought the whole county together. And if you just make, you can make, especially if you're younger, decisions in your life to live more simply. You don't need a big house. You don't need necessarily two cars if you plan carefully. And then maybe you don't have to have both parents going to work. I see a lot of young people who aren't thinking this way, who are buying these huge homes and just two new cars all the time. But there is something to simplifying your life and to be aware of all the consumerism out there, and to frequent mom and pop places. And because if you make decisions that way, then the change will happen eventually. That's it.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. I mean, as I personally look at this list, I mean, at times in the past, I have been very, I've been kind of fixated on, like we called, the holding actions, right? The stopping the harm. And I'm very skeptical of the emphasis on trying to address this through changes in our consumer choices, which is essentially a line that the energy companies and the corporations have fed us for the last 30, 40 years, that basically this is our fault. This is our fault because we buy the wrong things. And, you know, so they want to shift the blame onto the consumer. Again, I mean, we have culpability. Yes, we have responsibility for our choices. But even if all of us went out and like only bought green things, it's not going to change the problem at this point. So I'm always like skeptical about that. And also, like, I don't know, just the little things, right? I go like, oh, great, we have this massive problem. And then we're going to say, well, what can I do? I can, you know, bring my recyclable grocery bags to the grocery store, and I can like plant a tree in my yard. And I mean, that I've been skeptical of it in the sense that it just feels like we're just trying to make ourselves feel better. And it's just a little like consolation, and we're kind of turning our eyes away from the big problem and just trying like, oh, well, as long as I just do a couple things in my life, I'm doing my part. So that's my cynical side. But like, as we do this exercise and I think about this and think of all the different ways that this transformed society would look, you know, it's not just about, you know, no fossil fuels. It's about like a lot of things changing and becoming more life sustaining. And as we talk about them, then it seems like, oh, there's a lot of things in here, you know, you could start to get interested in, you could start to try to make this little part of it happen at least, right? So I don't know, I find it encouraging. Yeah. All right. I guess we're at 9. We are supposed to end at 9, right? On Sunday, I just ended 15 minutes early. I didn't realize it. Earth Peace Treaty Commitment Sheet. Interesting. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for participating. No, one more thing. I said I was going to talk about, like, okay, what's some little thing you could do? You could come this weekend to our Saturday event, the Interfaith Gathering at the Five Oaks site. So some of you would have heard this before, but this is a location just about 15 minutes here from the Zen Center. There's one ancient oak left. There are still five oaks. There used to be five very ancient oaks. And this is a location where they know that the native peoples, the Kalapuya, for hundreds of years before white people ever came here, would gather, particularly during acorn gathering and processing season. So it was a real gathering spot. And they would actually bury their mortars and pestles in the ground at that spot. And then just come back in the next year and they dig them up and use them. And then the Chattaquin and Google Maps there. So our idea is to stage these gatherings where we go out to some kind of significant spot in our area, connecting with a tree, with a location, with nature, and to make it contemplative. We'll have some guided meditation. We'll have some silent meditation. We'll have some words and some poetry and things like that. And a gesture, a ritual gesture of, we're going to, I guess I'll, should I tell people, Leah, we're going to do to the tree? All right. Well, you know those white prayer scarves that the Tibetan Buddhists use? And like, they're given as a, like, you know, at a significant event, and oftentimes they'll have a llama bless them and he'll put them back on your neck. Anyway, Leah has made us a really big one, and we're going to wrap the tree, put a prayer scarf around this big 600-year-old oak, and leave it there for a week. We'll see. It is at 2 p.m. We've mega kata. So two, and it'll be over by 3. It's just, and it'll be rain or shine. We did cancel it because of ice and snow last time, but this time that shouldn't happen. So it's rain or shine. And then on Sunday, and this is all information on the front page of our website. You can find either of these things. There is a Oregon Interfaith Earth Summit, Hope for Our Common Home. And I will be one of the speakers at that. And it's something that's available on Zoom. So anyway, it'll be just be encouraging hearing from different faith leaders about relating to this issue. But then there's also some practical stuff, like legislative stuff, and I don't know what's going on. So check that out too. And I find that the most important thing that comes out of these is community, is being with other people who are keyed into this, who care, who are doing things, who like have some hope, have some positive attitudes. And that is where I get my hope. I get my hope from other people, from seeing that they care, seeing their love, seeing their motivation, their creativity. It's not about what the likelihood of what might happen. It's like, well, there's some hope if we're here. So anyway, we offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.